Superior Court judge. Hello? Hello? You see, you have to ease into this. You don't step right in like it's cold water. Oh, no. No, 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 no. This is a hello? Hello? Well, hello, friend. A Superior Court judge dismissed assault charges against James D. Welch, 35, Friday, quote, in the interest of justice. Welch told the court he hit James E. Singleton, age 34, on the head with a 2x4 in a drive-in cafe when Singleton unexplainably reached over and poked his finger through Welch's cheeseburger. Any man who's going to look at the world with any degree of objectivity, you know, there was a writer. I don't recall who it was. I think it might have been, by George, I think it was Dorothy Kilgallen when she was covering one of those murder trials. I think Dorothy Kilgallen, or was it Earl Wilson, said that in any action, the smallest action of man, the microcosm, can be expanded to encompass all actions of all men everywhere. Yes, it was Kilgallen, come to think of it. And so I think this explains basically very much about our world situation today. I will repeat it again. Now, if we can take the action, because every single thing that happens, anything that a man does, can be found within each one of us. We are all potential murderers. Now, madam, do not deny it. Stop it. We are all potential saints. There's a little streak of that, too, in us. Now, that's a little small one. That's a ee-witsy-bitsy one, but it's there, you see. We are all potential almost anything you care to name. In fact, we are all potential anything you can name that man has done at one time or another. Now, I repeat, see, James Welch was sitting there in the drive-in, and suddenly James Singleton, who was 1 year his junior, by the way, he's 34, reached over and without any explanation at all, stuck his hand through, or his finger anyway, through Welch's cheeseburger. Welch then hit him on the head with a 2x4. Now, you know what a 2x4 is? A 2x4 is the hand-to-hand combat equivalent of a nuclear bomb. I don't know whether you've ever been on the head with a 2x4, but that's a big hunk of wood. By the way, the 2x4 does not measure 2x4, in case you're interested. Is the trivial bits of information that it doesn't, you know. No, it doesn't. I know, that's what always disappoints people. So here you've got the situation, the world situation. Now, James D. Welch could be the United States and Singleton could be Russia. The cheeseburger could be Berlin. Or any place you care to name. It could be Cuba. It could be Laos, could be any place else, you know. It's just sitting over there, apparently an innocent bystander, but it isn't, you see. It was really the raison d'etre. It was the cause. There it sits there, that old cheeseburger. So Singleton reached over and put his finger through Welch's cheeseburger. Welch hit him on top of the head with a 2x4. And everything hit the fan. Now, neither one could explain why the other did what he did, nor could he even explain why he did what he did. Now, it's quite obvious that when Singleton was asked about the cheeseburger, why did you stick your finger through the cheeseburger, he said, because it was there. I mean, there it was. It was a cheeseburger, and somehow, it was a finger through there. And Singleton, when questioned why he hit him on the head with a 2x4, said, because he stuck his finger through my cheeseburger. And that's, well, is a cheeseburger worth that much? 30 cents, you could have got another one. 45, 60 cents. Now look at the guy. He's got a knot on his head. 4 days in the hospital. You're here in the court. Was it worth it? Well, yes. So there you got it, you know. Now you cannot explain man's actions at all. Don't try. By the way, I'd like to tell you something before we get any further. You can tell I've got a bad cold, right? Well, I don't want to alarm anybody, but recently medical scientists have found that the common cold is spread. Interestingly enough, you know, it's a very, very difficult problem about colds that don't stand too close to your loudspeaker. You can get a cold seriously. A cold is transmitted in one way, one type of cold, electronically. Do you know that? Interestingly enough, you can get a cold from listening to me too closely. Now, at this point, it's at the very, very difficult stage. Do you know that There have been vast nationwide cold epidemics, and no one knew why it happened. The last 5 or 6 years, and all over the country, colds all over. And they found out they were catching it from Ed Sullivan. Yeah, it's a fact. It's even worse. It's more virulent on TV. So I just thought that you should be warned before we go any further that you're liable to get a real beezer from this one. I mean, you better get back to PAT where things are safe and soft. And all string. Don't worry about that. Eternal string all the time. It's much safer down there. You won't catch a cold from it. You'll have to catch something else, but it won't be a cold. Like dry rot. But that's another thing. I mean, we all got that in one way or another, so there's no problem there. You know, this was not an anti-fellow radio station remark. It's just a comment on the way, you know, we are. I mean, you're all skating along on very thin ice. We're skating along there, pretending that the ice is thicker than it really is, you know, actually. But if you want to get any further than that, now this guy swatted one guy. And of course, I'll say this, that you here in the East don't know what a drive-in is, do you? Really? They don't have drive-ins here in the East. Not at all like they have in the Midwest or the Southwest or the Far West. Now, the drive-in is genuinely an institution out there. And that's one of the things that I noticed when I first came East, along with chili parlors, is that there's hardly any real, genuine, actual drive-ins. Now, Howard Johnson is not a drive-in. Howard Johnson is just a restaurant on the road, that's all. But you know what a drive-in is? A drive-in is a place that has no tables at all. It doesn't have a counter. And it just is it's like a little island in the middle of a giant parking lot. You know, what it is a drive-in movie without the screen. That's all. Now you can understand it. See? Incidentally, my lone visit to a drive-in movie within recent years came a couple of years ago. No, a couple of years. It was last spring, actually. Seems like years ago. I mean, there's been the Berlin crisis since then, you know, and 14 cabinets have risen and fallen. France has exploded. There's been 7 new governments over there. And I mean, time moves much faster now. But last spring, I went to this drive-in and theater, you see, and I found that the movie there is merely a byproduct of going to the drive-in. And no one really watches the movie there. You could put anything on. You could put a blank screen on there, you know, and with little flutters once in a while. Everyone would be happy with a loudspeaker with Derwood Kirby's voice coming out of it. And no one would pay any attention, actually, because what they are giant Chinese restaurants. Outdoor Chinese restaurants. That's, I think, very interesting. The idea of having French fried shrimp, Cantonese style. In a drive-in movie. I mean, it's a very interesting situation there. Of course, movies have always been associated in one way or another with exotica. You know, what is it, exotica? There is a movie on the outskirts. Well, it's not really in the outskirts of Chicago. It's on the south side of Chicago. The movie called The Avalon. Now, movies were always called things like that in the early. Of course, this was the dream world. Somehow, movies were terribly influenced by the Moors. It was a Moorish influence that was unmistakable among movie houses. Oh, yes, Moorish architecture. Interestingly enough, the Moors had never seen a movie. Well, for years and years, the first movie didn't reach Moorland until late 1937. And then it was a 16-millimeter hand-operated job that showed nothing but Irene Castle shorts about how you should be kind to dogs. Kick people in the fanny, but go easy on the dogs, was the general philosophy of those movies. But nevertheless, here you had the Moors, and I remember, I'm a kid, you know, it was more of an experience to go to the movie house than it was to see the pictures, which were generally letdowns, you know, guys riding across the screen with the horses and all that stuff. But going to the movie house was a fantastic operation. Right in the, first of all, you'd walk in, and there's the lobby, see. In the lobby, they had this big, well, it was kind of a plum-colored pond, really, with swans. Now, I don't know whether you know anything about swans, but the swans that lived in the movie houses in Chicago lived on Wrigley gum, old Wrigley gum. And they had developed a peculiar kind of swan, actually. Boy, I don't know whether you've ever seen a constipated swan. They are very angry people. And we'd come in there, and of course the swan, and it has not changed a bit. Hardly anybody really looks at the movie. Now, like the other night, I cannot understand. A friend of mine, I don't know what's going on with things generally, but I'm just going to relate to you something that is one of those inexplicable things of our time. I read this review, and the review starts out, and here's the way it goes. It starts out, and it says, what do you do when you're a reviewer? When you're faced with perfection, what do you do? Well, of course, I'm always a sucker for a review of that kind. So the review went on and just, oh, it was embarrassing. You know, it's bad enough when you see a reviewer let's say, be ineffectually angry in a review, but it's terrible when a reviewer is weeping sentimental tears. You know, it's all squishy coming out of the magazine there. And it's a magazine noted for its tough reviews. So I said, I got to see this. Well, I get down at this movie house, and I arrive there, and just about the time the movie... First of all, I'm in the front row. Have you ever seen, how long has it been since you sat in the front row at a movie? I'll tell you, my eyeballs were bugging before the first guy came out on the screen. It's fascinating. You really see the imperfections of a picture when you're down there. Well, I'm sitting in the first row of this movie house, and the movie begins. Now, what I'm trying to say here is that most of us are conditioned before we do anything. We're conditioned to believe we like things. We're conditioned to believe we don't like them. We're conditioned in a million different ways, and hardly ever do we really look at what is in front of us so that we see. We got to know what is what. So I'm sitting in this movie house, and I guess I was in a really advantageous position because I was already disenchanted because I was in the front row and the air conditioning was blowing in one ear and out the other. It's fantastic. Let me tell you this about the air conditioning in most New York movie houses. It's an interesting thing. I find that most New York movie houses are colder than we would stand if it was wintertime. If we went into a movie house and it was that cold, we'd complain to the manager. Somehow it's considered great in the summertime. I mean, it's a wild thing. So it's about, I'd say, roughly 37 degrees. And I'm sitting in there, the wind is blowing past me, and my eyeballs are bugging, and the movie starts. It's a French movie. Well, of course, as you know, all the reviewers here in New York are either, and they alternate, they're either Anglophiles or Francophiles, which is to say that they dig anything that's French more than anything, or they dig anything that's English more than anything. And you get to know what what reviewer it is that does this, you see. And, of course, the hip reviewers put everything down. Everything, you see, except the movies they make, which they make on an experimental basis, groping towards the truth, as they say. So this gets to be... One of the reviewers from the Village Voice just completed a movie that was based on groping for the truth. They're still groping, I understand. But that's beside that. As long as you grope for the truth, that's all right. Well, anyway, I go to this movie, and I'm sitting there in the front row, and speaking of groping for the truth, this is WOR AM and FM in New York. No. Ed, we're having confusion there. E.T. WOR AM and FM, New York.
You refines away harsh flavor, refines away hot taste. It makes the taste of a cigarette mild as a balmy day in the month of May. It is the best for the flavor you like. It is the best for the flavor you
refines
like.
Refines away harsh flavor. Refines away hot taste.
For the flavor
it makes the taste of a cigarette mild as a balmy day in the month of May. It is the best
with the micronite filter.
It is the best.
We have General Tire with us. And if you're planning to invest in some tires in the near future, we suggest you see your friendly, reliable, sober, industrious, brave, clean, reverent General Tire dealer. He can be trusted. And by the way, he's up to his hocks in inner tubes. And so you might be able to work a good deal with him. You know what happens when a guy gets desperate. That's your General Tire dealer. We also have with us a Martha Dean... Oh, yes, a Martha Dean promotion. It says... Here's a party you won't want to miss. Among the guests will be Robert Preston, H. Allen Smith, Gloria Swanson, James Thurber, Arthur Treacher, Milton Caniff, and many other important types. They'll be joining Martha Dean Thursday and Friday at 10:15 to help celebrate her 20th anniversary at WOR. Well, now, you see, that's it. You notice that Martha didn't invite any of her friends from around here? I'm not invited. I've probably known her longer than Milton Caniff has. But, you know, all right, Martha, we can tell, boy, when the chips are down, who you invite, the important people. I don't see, I don't see Dora McCann on that list. I don't see Ed and Fagin Fitzgerald on that. No, important types. When you're throwing a party, Martha, who do you invite? Shepard? No. That's right. Okay, wait till we throw our 20th anniversary party for whatever it might be, Martha. you know what I'll do? I'll invite you, and you'll feel rotten. I know you're a type, Martha. Name dropper. Well, all right. All right, George. Well, of course, you get used to that. That's this business. It's full of knives. It's full of people. Well, you know, on the other hand, I'm sitting in this movie. I want to finish the story. I'm sitting in this movie, see, and I waited in line. It's one of those rare times I wait in line to see a movie. This is ridiculous. Wait in line to live in the dream world, you know? So I get in that movie house, and I sit down there, and the movie starts. Well, I know I'm in trouble right away. The star of the picture appears on the screen and does nothing for the first 3 minutes, but, however, the audience is convulsed. I have seen nothing to even crack the corners of my mouth yet, and they are convulsed. Well, it progresses from bad to worse. The audience is falling out of its seats. All the way through, they're screaming and hollering. I figure, well, maybe they're getting the message I'm not getting. So I look at it from the other side. You know, I keep tilting my head. And he's a pleasant actor, you know, very, yeah, and a pleasant guy. What he is kind of like, if you can imagine, a watered-down Jack Lemmon. I mean, Jack Lemmon is strongly watered in the first. This is a watered-down Lemmon, you see. Well, so I'm sitting there watching this, and I'm waiting for the funny stuff to happen, and the audience is screaming and falling off. You know, they're screaming like mad. Those high-pitched giggles, you know, and they're falling and hitting their head on the. I can hear them bumping against the seats, and it was embarrassing. Then I really realized that I was up against something really bad, is when this clown leaves the stage, you see. He's off now, and there's another scene going on, and this time something funny actually does happen, and nobody laughs. I'm the only clown that's roaring. The first funny scene that's happened in the picture. Well, I couldn't figure this. This happened all the way through the picture. Well, I get home and I look at the review again, and it seems that they have compared this guy with a cross between Chaplin, W.C. Fields, Joe DiMaggio, Mickey Mantle, and one of the lesser-known saints of the 14th century. So I figure, you know, I hadn't been properly indoctrinated, and you know, I was laughing at the wrong guys in the picture, you see. Well, I couldn't figure this out, and then. And this has happened to me repeatedly in the last couple of months with foreign movies that have come to town. And I I'm on the way out, and I hear, oh, isn't he wonderful? Isn't he fantastic? I didn't even know his name, you see. This guy that came on the screen and did this stuff. Well, I realized then, again, the importance of indoctrination. It is a very important thing. Now, like, we had in the Army a thing called, did you ever hear about this thing? They called it orientation. Now, do you know what is it, orientation? Well, it's roughly this. Bunch of guys get in the signal corps, see, and they're all nearsighted, and they got glasses. And they're skinny. All these guys. Well, of course, the first thing that they got to be orientated. By the way, one of the favorite words in the Army is to be orientated. Now, I don't know whether there is such a word, but they constantly use it in the Army. It says, now, of course, you're not yet orientated, boy. Well, I'm inducted, and I'm with a bunch of other clowns, and this is my first real. Of course, our orientation goes on so gradually and so continually that. Few of us know anything about it. It's like you have to be totally orientated to truly understand a New Yorker short story. This is a fact, you know. It's all full of little itsy-bitsy New York jokes, little itsy-bitsy New York phraseologies, and little itsy-bitsy New York neuroses. You know, like eastbound buses are more respectable than westbound buses. They don't know about that in Pittsburgh, you know. Nor do they care. And, of course, the belief of a New Yorker, seriously, any New Yorker feels that anybody who doesn't live in New Yorker is what he generically calls an out-of-towner or a tourist. Now, you see, even a guy in Cincinnati, living in Cincinnati at the time is looked upon as an out-of-towner by a New Yorker in Cincinnati. It's a very, very difficult problem, you see. So, I mean, it's all complicated. So, naturally, J.D. Salinger is a natural outgrowth of the New Yorker. Seriously, because he's got all of them, you know. He's a quiz kid and all this jazz, all his little New Yorker attitudes. A guy, believe me, living in Chillicothe, Ohio, never thinks of a quiz kid being anything but a thing that comes out of the radio. You never are actually that, you know. You don't go up into the mountains in Vermont and write haiku. Not in Chillicothe, you don't. You go out and fist fight with the elements. So there's a whole different set of problems. And unfortunately, art is supposed to be universal. Well, if you live south of 14th Street, you're in trouble trying to understand the New Yorker short stories. Let me tell you that. And if you live north of 110th Street, you're in trouble. And if you live east of First Avenue, you understand all of it in a three-block area, like around Sutton Place. Now if you live on the west, oh, don't forget it. If you're over there somewhere around Amsterdam, don't try it. I mean, you're in trouble from the first minute you start going through that. See, it's not about New York at all. It's about nine blocks, see, really, is what these things are about. So you know, it's funny. Everybody lives in his own little cubicle. I would like to see a genuine New Yorker magazine. I mean, it would be wild, you know, wouldn't it? I mean, about New York. I mean, I'm not talking about E.B. White. I'm talking about New York. There's a wonderful little sentimentality that runs through most New Yorker magazines. And I'm not talking about New Yorker here in this case, of the New Yorker New Yorker. I'm saying that runs through New York published magazines. And it is the I'm a sensitive person syndrome. I'm a sensitive person living in an insensitive world syndrome. This runs through almost all magazines published in New York. The Reporter, I can name a dozen of them. Village Voice. The Village Voice, the New Yorker, the Reporter. Most of them are organizations or magazines devoted to right thinking, as represented by us. And unless you can really honestly say with a straight face to people around you, I am a sensitive person and the world is a hard, rough, rotten world, and that I'm going to go up into the Vermont hills and write haiku, then you're in trouble, you know? If you really seriously believe that nobody has... he's wrong. See, he missed the point entirely. So did you. You could not convince J.D. Salinger that the quiz kids were from Chicago because they weren't. This is a fact. You're wrong again. All I'm saying is that there is an interesting set of values that is related to the sensitive person today, as opposed to all other persons. Yeah, that is a very interesting problem. Now, we know. Now, you're, for example, I got in an argument today with a guy, and he says it is obvious that Truman could not have been a good president. And you know what his argument was? You will not believe what his argument was. He was from Kansas City. What do you mean? He's Kansas City. What? You know anything about Kansas City? Well, now, what does that show, you say? That shows a very fascinating kind of snobism. Well... he seriously said it to me. I said, well, now, I suppose... Now, of course, Adlai Stevenson would be the sensitive person's ideal of a president because he speaks with a beautifully modulated Princeton accent and seems vaguely sad. So this is the ideal, the Beau ideal, as a matter of fact. In fact, the general air of the retreating person today is very, very... appealing to the theoretical man, the non-doer. In other words, the worst thing you can do is to actually write the novel if you're in a coffee shop on McDougal Street. That's the worst possible thing you can do. And I can tell you this, that the absolute worst possible thing you can do if you're on Sullivan Street is to stop writing about love and become in love. In other words, writing about love is one thing, being in love is another. Generally, people who are in love do not write about being in love. It is my experience. But any time, if I were a chick and a poet wrote a long, epic poem to me about how much he loved me, I'd kick the bum out in 5 minutes. I know that he's faking it up all the way. Believe me, I'm serious about it. And anytime a chick starts leaving little itsy bitsy notes for me, she's on her way out. I'm serious. because when you start putting it on paper, then you stop putting it into action. One generally takes the place of the other. And hardly the twain do meet. How long has it been since you've had a good long twain ride, huh? I'm sorry. I wish I could be serious in the face of present world difficulties. But you see, it's too much of a carnival. I mean, it's like H.L. Mencken once wrote. He says he's writing to a friend of his overseas in Paris, a matter of fact. And he was writing in 1910 or 1911, something like that. And he says, Charlie, he says, you better get back fast. He says, the circus, the big show is getting so fantastic you won't believe it. He says, we're about to get into a war. They're about to vote prohibition in. They're about to do all kinds of nutty things. He says, boobery is becoming rampant. He says, don't miss it. Get back here quick. It's fantastic. Well, nothing has changed. Not a bit of it. Speaking of boobery, you want to hear the most recent one? I think this should be accompanied by sweet sentimental guitar music. Where is it? All right, give me some guitar music there while I'm waiting, Ted. It's a time, you know. So what happened was that afterwards, me and my friend were sitting there. We're in the next place. We go into a restaurant that was even colder than the theater we had come out of. And all the people are sitting in there freezing, eating ice cream sundaes. And you know, it's interesting. Once in a while, one of the penitents would get up to cool off outside where it was warm, you know, get back into real life. There's no wonder. To me, it's no mystery why so much of the completely unrealistic literature and attitudes and beliefs about the world come out of New York City. This is a completely unreal city. Do you know that you can live all of your adolescent years entirely surrounded by air conditioning machines in this city? That a typhoon is totally, it's a thing you read about. And they call them friendly names here in New York, like Typhoon Freddy or Hurricane Max. You know, the friendly little names. They're not things that blow people out of their seats and knock down the buildings. Now, this is the interesting, unreal world we live here in New York. That's wild. It's fascinating. Of course, all right, you ready? No, just any cut. It doesn't matter. Just any cut. Just bring it on and bring it in. Now, speaking of boobery is still rampant. And I read to you from one of my favorite humor papers, the Philadelphia Bulletin, from Topeka, Kansas, which, by the way, when Lincoln was about to pass on the scene, they asked him what he was most proud of that he had done. And he wrote in a letter to a guy, among other things, he said, "Well, actually, I've only done maybe two or three things that I really think I pulled off." He said, "I wrote a book about the American language." And incidentally, if you've never read it, you have missed a genuine reading experience. Mencken's book on the American language is a genuine classic and will be read 100 years from now. But then he went on to say, "There are two other things that I am proud about. I coined the word boobwazee." The boobwazee. Well, he didn't live to see television flourish. No telling what he would have said about that. And he says, "The other thing that I did that I'm proud of is I coined the phrase the Bible Belt." Well, deep in the heart of the Bible Belt lies Topeka, Kansas. And I'm going to read to you what the latest episode of the boobwazee is in that department. Kansas. "Oh, fair flower of the western plains. Oh, Kansas. O fair propagator of the eternal sunflower. O soft Kansas, steeped in a long history of crusaders against drinking, tobacco, gambling, and violators of the Sabbath, had a new champion today. He is Robert Brown, Shawnee County attorney in this capital city, who said he is now ready to prosecute anyone selling cigarettes to minors. Brown said there is a law in this state, and has been since 1933, providing a $25 to $500 fine or jail sentences up to 6 months for anyone convicted of selling or even giving cigarettes to anyone under 21 years of age. If anyone wants to sign a complaint, I'll prosecute. I believe it could be and would be enforceable. I'll bet 99% of the people in this town don't know this is the law," Brown said yesterday. The state, one of the last to repeal laws against intoxicating liquor, once had a law that forbade sale of cigarettes or even cigarette papers to anyone, regardless of age, at any time of the day or night. Of course, it led to widespread bootlegging and was repealed in the mid-1920s amid much hoopla and hullabaloo. What do the teenagers think of Brown's statement? "What if my dad gives me a pack of cigarettes?" asked one youngster. "Could they put him in jail?" Brown preferred not to answer that one. "Say, that would be weird," said Duncan Newcomer, an 18-year-older. "You can buy beer if you're 18, but you would get the drugstore in a mess if you bought a pack of smokes. I don't figure that one out." "Duncan, you are just beginning the long trail of life. There will be many things you can't figure out. But by the time you reach 30, you will no longer say that. You will pretend that you can figure things out, which is the great delusion and snare. What are they going to do to a cigarette machine in the city hall?" asked Larry Miller, 19, of Kansas City, Kansas. "Are they going to put the machine in jail for 6 months? It's run by the city hall, you know." "Stop it now. You can't fight city hall, Larry, even if you are 19. Put it out of your skull." "Well, wouldn't that be something?" said a dancer at the Starlight Theater in Kansas City, who is also a teenage wife as well as an adept stripper. If they put my husband in jail for giving me cigarettes, wouldn't that be something? Whoops! Da-da-da. Donald Barge, 17, of Paola, Kansas, put it succinctly. I roll my own. I can't be bothered. Good luck. Good luck, angry Robert Brown. I am not making a statement in favor of teenagers smoking, so do not misinterpret me. I am merely making a statement of commiseration for unblunted, unmitigated bourgeoisie anger. All in the wrong direction. It's like this recent campaign that put all the bookstores in the village out of business on Sunday afternoon, but all the strip joints are running. The taverns and every other place. So, Duncan, don't try to figure it out. George Ade said it a long time before you came on the scene. Don't try to figure anything out. Stop it. I mean, it is an illusion, seriously. If you really believe that you've got it pegged, you ain't. Just about the time you got it pegged, out goes the rug, down the chute you go. And you're 4 miles out to sea. All right, that's enough of the guitar music. Stop it. Just thought you ought to know that Kansas is still swinging. But it gives you a sense of... You know, I'll tell you one thing. I remember when I was a kid. Now, you think this is ridiculous, but I'll tell you a story about that. That everywhere you go, whatever it is that you're against is actually, in a way, related to, in most areas in the country, whatever you're against is related, in some sense or another, to religion. This is fascinating. Now, if you're against cigarettes, and you really are against them, somehow you'll find a way to bring religion into it. If you're against short skirts, you will find that you can bring religion into it, somehow. If you're against playing the banjo on Sunday morning, you can find something that, you know, that will back up your whatever it is that you back it up. Now, this is a fascinating thing, and I can remember one time when I was a kid, there was a town outside of Chicago, Illinois, that had one of the most fascinating examples of what Mencken called the bourgeoisie rampant. Now, they had declared, the guy that ran the town, I don't know whether you ever heard about this town, but it's a very interesting thing. This guy that ran the town, somehow he had gotten control of the town. Now, he got control of the town using the Big Daddy principle. Now, this is a different way than we are used to. This is not the kind of guy that gets in control of the town politically. He is the spiritual father. And he takes over the morals of all the people in town and runs the town the way he sees fit, basing everything that he does on moralistic grounds, not on grounds any other than that. Interestingly enough, you will find that many Southern segregationists trot out the Bible to back up their beliefs. Are you aware of that? That no matter what awful thing you want to do, you can always find something somewhere that can be interpreted in some way that will excuse you, get you off the hook, and give you official theological sanction on top of it. Well, this is the way it worked. Down in this little town, just a minute now, we'll wait till after the show, in this little town outside of Chicago, they taught that the earth was flat. Well, why did they teach this? Because the guy that ran the town said it was. That no one had proved to him otherwise, so hence that made the earth flat. Now, conversely, nobody who believes the earth is flat can prove that the earth is flat. They have never been able to prove. This is the old flying saucer syndrome, you know, that most people who are flying saucer addicts, and they are addicted, most flying saucer addicts base their arguments on the fact that because you can't prove there aren't flying saucers, that proves there are. It's a very interesting kind of backward. There is a word. I wish I could. There's another word that goes in front of backward. Type of non-scientific, scientific reasoning. I mean, you know, that the scientist, he goes the other way around, you know. The scientific reasoning means that you must prove a thesis. Now, if you can't prove a thesis, that does not prove that the thesis is correct or disprove, you see. So it gets all very complicated. Anyway, this guy taught that the earth was flat. Now, there was a law in the town there. And by the way, I'd like to point out that they were still teaching in this town the earth is flat until well into the late 1940s. Are you aware of that? This was not in 1904. So I'm just pointing out this is going on all over. So they were teaching the Earth is flat in spite of all those little things that are flying around, like those little, you know, those little things we've been shooting up here recently. And so that doesn't matter, you know, that doesn't prove anything. You know how they would argue that one? I never seen one of them things. Have you? I don't believe they shot them things up. It's all promotion. That's what it is. It's all one of them things. They're just a lot of talk. Well, this is the kind of argument. By the way, I've read this argument seriously advanced in political columns here in New York City. I don't believe them Russians sent that guy up there. I never saw him. Did you? Well, that proves that they aren't there. Be careful. I never saw an atom bomb. I don't believe there are such things. Well, I don't know whether you ever saw a nuclear bomb, Dorothy, but be careful. There's liable to be such a thing. And you are liable to see it 1 millisecond too late. I mean, before you can get the column written. So nevertheless, there's a fascinating thing. He taught that the Earth was square. Well, now, philosophically, he might have been right. Geographically, there is a question about it. Now, he taught that the Earth, well, he didn't say really square, he said flat. Now, he went further than that because, you see, he had to explain about that sky up there, you see, that the thing that the, you know, everybody sees the sky. What about that? And what about them stars up there? So you know what he said about the stars. I'll tell you what the stars are. He said, the sky is 30 miles high. That's right. He says, it is, by my computations, he said, I got my bifocals out one day and I measured the square root of the hypotenuse, and I have figured that it is 30 miles high. And he trotted out three obscure passages from the early Old Testament to prove that the sky is 30 miles high. They had very good sextants and things in those days and a lot of fine computers. It was easy to compute the sky's height in those days. It's 30 miles high. And you know how he explained the stars? He says the sky actually is a fine film. It's a blanket, actually, up there that's blue-colored. He says, now, when you see those stars up there, those are holes in it. And he says there's a strong light that is heaven that's just on the other side of that 30, and it's shining through. So every night, everybody would go up and look at the stars, and they knew they were looking at heaven, peeking at it, sort of, you know, peeping Tom, like sneaking a peek through the hole in the blanket. Well, he taught this seriously, and it had to be taught in the schools by law, not by any other way, by law. Now, this is a sneaky kind of thing. Well, I remember one thing that he taught also. He taught that smoking cigarettes was immoral. Well, he found somewhere in the someplace that smoking cigarettes was immoral. Well, so what they did, they put a big sign out there in the entrance of town. Anyone found smoking cigarettes within this city limits will be subjected to a $100 fine or 30 days in jail or both if the boss sees fit. Well, I'm serious about this. If you drove into town in your car and you were 10 feet the other side of the city limit sign, there was a big hand laid on your shoulder if you were smoking a Lucky. Well, it got to be a very interesting thing. You'd be surprised how the Chicagoans discovered 4,000 different roads around that town, just outside the city limits. It was the most unvisited town in the Western Hemisphere, you know? And it was fascinating. And, oh, by the way, he passed another law. He said, I can find a passage in the scriptures that shows that them silk stockings are immoral, that it is now immoral to wear silk stockings in the city limits here, in this town. And do you know, ladies and gentlemen, that silk stockings were immoral in that town till well into the 1940s, and today even many a young maiden blushes when she wears a pair of silk stocking ringless nylons out on the street before darkness falls. And so you see, the forces are still there. Just thought you ought to know. Now all I can say to Mr. Welch and the Mr. Singleton, one of them who suffered a finger put through his cheeseburger without provocation, the other who suffered a 2x4 back of the ear because of his predilection toward desecrating cheeseburgers. All I can say is, well, you know, fellas, I know how you both feel, and that's my problem. I wish I could get hot under the collar for one or to the other of you. You know, you get a lot further ahead in life if you can get really steamed up about something. If you can really blank out and get real hot under the collar about one side of the argument or the other, you're bound to become an important commentator or a big politician, or maybe you're liable even to become bigger than that. I guess I, well, of course, time and time. Good luck. Good luck.